Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Tuesday, April 16th, day 193 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borchel-Dan here with our Arab Affairs reporter Luca Pacchiani and political reporter Sam Sokol. Thanks for joining me, gentlemen.
Good morning, Amanda.
Morning.
Luca will dive into the tightrope performance Jordan gave in deflecting some of the over 300 projectiles and drones shot by Iran to Israel late Saturday night. And in light of the country's massive Palestinian population, we'll hear whether this was a popular move. We'll also hear about a conversation he conducted with Gazan journalist Sami Obaid, who had a counterintuitive solution for the day after the war. Sam is here and we'll discuss coalition politics and drama at the Knesset. All this and more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Luca, Israel has today reassured Arab countries in the region that its response to Iran's attack will not place them in danger, amid concerns from several countries that they would be held accountable by Tehran in the event of an Israeli retaliatory strike. Obviously, one such Arab country is Jordan, which was a player in foiling the Iran strike. So talk to us about how this is an even more complicated situation than some of our other neighbors because of the large Palestinian population.
So Jordan's really caught between a rock and a hard place here. On the one hand, they're a member of the Middle East Air Defense Alliance. On the other hand, as you said, over half of the Jordanian population is of Palestinian origin, and the country over the past weeks has witnessed daily protests, especially in their last days of Ramadan, calling on the government to break diplomatic ties with Israel. So obviously they can't pull out of the alliance with the US. They get enormous benefits from their peace treaty with Israel and from their being one of the most strategic allies of the US in the region. Jordan is a miracle of stability thanks to that help in a region where, you know, there's Iraq, Syria on their borders. And so they decided to do the right thing, but they are really trying to downplay it with their own public opinion and before the eyes of the Arab world. So if you had a look at the Jordanian press on Sunday morning, a few hours after the attack, you had no idea that there were tons of explosives flying, crossing the country's skies on the way from Iran to Israel the night before. They were just talking about like these foreign objects as if it was UFOs that were downed, on the justification that they vowed that we shoot down any foreign objects, whether they come from Israel or Iran. But in an official statement by the government, they said that basically they called on all parties to reduce tensions, and they wouldn't even mention who those parties are. It's as if the whole thing never happened. And again, there was this like random flying object through the sky that they had to intercept.
Luca, if I'm not mistaken, the Jordanian press is government-controlled, or at least controlled by the monarchy, correct? And so what we're hearing that you're saying that was printed is essentially the monarchy line.
Correct. And one of the government ministers also called on the media to basically get all their information from government sources, because there had been rumors that a state of emergency had been declared. But we're basically telling them, you know, don't say anything that we don't want you to say, we don't want you to come out publicly saying that we're involved in this Iran-Israel thing. But the thing is, we know that actually some of these rockets fell on Jordanian soil. People saw them. People saw the rockets flying above their heads. I actually spoke with a freelance journalist who was in Amman that night, and she said that she heard some of her neighbors screaming in panic, but also some of them shouting Allahu Akbar, you know, because Israel hate is so widespread in Jordan among the population.
So while the press can be controlled by the government, the social media cannot. And both in Israel and outside of Israel, there are a bunch of memes, including one of the king wearing an Israeli uniform and one of the princess with claims that she shot down something like 5 or 6 drones herself because she is a pilot, as we've seen in the delivery of the humanitarian aid to Gaza. What did you see, Luca?
Yeah, so there's been an enormous backlash on social media against the actions of the king. And he's being blamed personally for his alliance with Israel. The thing about the princess was actually not true. It was a rumor like many that we see all the time on social media. But the king specifically is being called a traitor, a supporter of the genocidal Zionists, someone who's turned his back on the Palestinian cause, things like that. As I said, he's between a rock and a hard place, really. It's not an easy time for him.
I took the meme with the princess to be more like a fish that was this big. She caught a fish this big, and people were so excited to see that.
Yeah.
Sam, let's turn to you. On Sunday, far-right members of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government issued strident calls for Israel to react to Iran's strike on Israel with a show of force, while other moderate members of the coalition, including War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz, urged a balanced approach. So where are we standing now, several days later, in terms of who is calling for what?
So, yeah, we have seen some of the more far-right members of the coalition use very, very hawkish rhetoric. National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir demanded what he called a crushing counterattack and said that the only way to create deterrence is to, quote, go crazy and to shed restraint and proportionality. His calls were echoed by fellow ultranationalist Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. But while these are the loudest voices, and there is political pressure in the coalition for a retaliatory strike, it's very important to note two things. One, many lawmakers, including very hawkish ones, have, unlike Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, tempered their calls by saying we need to retaliate at a time and in a manner of our choosing, and we need to maintain our ability to work with our multinational partners. And it's important to note that the Security Cabinet voted final decision-making on these issues, on how to retaliate, to the War Cabinet, which is essentially Defense Minister Gallant, National Unity Minister Benny Gantz, and Bibi himself. There are other observers, but they're essentially the ones who are making the decision. Now, there are media reports that during the strike itself, members of the War Cabinet wanted to launch an immediate counterstrike against Iran, but that has sort of, that push has died down when we realized that we were able to handle the bulk of the incoming projectiles. And that allowed us the flexibility to really sit and think about what is the best way to do this. Now, what we've heard publicly from people like Gantz is basically our response has to be calibrated in a way to coordinate with the United States and with our partners and to, you know, keep our alliance, anti-Iran alliance together and to strengthen it. So, you know, it's very unclear what Israel is going to do. What is clear is that the most strident and the loudest voices don't necessarily represent the decision-making process at the moment.
Okay, so speaking of loud and strident voices, as if there wasn't enough drama in Israel yesterday, National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir's far-right Otzma Yehudit party said that it was no longer bound by coalition discipline following opposition by ultra-Orthodox coalition parties to an expansion of his authority. So first of all, what was this proposed expansion?
So the government had decided that it wanted to transfer authority over a real estate inspection unit from the finance ministry to the national security ministry. Essentially, this would give Ben-Gvir the power to oversee the enforcement of regulations concerning illegal building, especially in the Arab sector. Ben-Gvir has framed this as part of efforts to combat rising crime in the Arab sector, while critics have said that this is essentially another way for Ben-Gvir to crack down on the Arab sector and discriminate against them. Now, the ultra-Orthodox were the ones who came out and opposed this, which one might not have expected. And the reason for this is that Ben-Gvir himself had previously helped to torpedo legislation that they wanted concerning regulations on so-called kosher phones. The ultra-Orthodox use what are called kosher phones, old-style feature phones like you or I might have used in the late 90s, early 2000s, that don't have internet, don't have SMS, that are limited in who they can receive calls from in order to help maintain their communal isolation. And the ultra-Orthodox were pushing legislation which would have helped cement the way that the current system works in law and to even expand it. And Ben-Gvir had differences on that legislation, pushed back against it. And this is the ultra-Orthodox basically saying, if you don't support what we want, we're going to tank what you want. And there was supposed to be a vote to approve the transfer of powers yesterday in a special Knesset plenum session that was called despite the ongoing Knesset recess. And when the ultra-Orthodox told Ben-Gvir, you know, we're not supporting you, this led to last-minute frenzied negotiations on the sidelines of the Knesset, which ultimately went nowhere, and the entire issue was dropped from the Knesset agenda and wasn't ultimately voted on. And in his anger at the ultra-Orthodox, Ben-Gvir basically said, until they support me in what I want, I don't feel bound to vote with the coalition. What that's going to mean practically, you know, remains to be seen, because it's hard to see them voting, you know, for left-wing legislation to vote in favor of no confidence motions in Netanyahu, but it's strongly symbolic.
All right, Sam, thanks for all this, and we're going to say goodbye and go to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie. Their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Luca, since 1997, Sami Obaid, a 65-year-old Gazan journalist, has appeared frequently in Israeli media as a political commentator. And even today, or especially today, he provides a rare source of inside information on what is happening in Gaza. I wonder, however, if his opinions are so representative, because in a long interview you conducted with him, he had some surprising suggestions for how to rule Gaza the day after the war. First of all, what was the suggestion?
So, as you said, the question of who's going to rule Gaza after war is on everyone's mind. And his suggestion was that Israel should just annex Gaza at this point. It doesn't want Hamas in power. It doesn't really trust or want the Palestinian Authority. And he says it's the best option, basically, that Israel take over Gaza. They can rebuild the settlements if they want, that were pulled out in 2005, but on condition that the Gazan population also gets Israeli citizenship. Basically, they should get the same status as Israeli Arabs. It's actually not such an outlandish proposal. It's something that I've heard from Palestinians in the West Bank more and more in recent years, again, because there's no political horizon to the establishment of a Palestinian state. The thing about Sami Obaid is that he actually knows Israelis quite well. His Hebrew is actually quite good. And he spends 8 years in Tel Aviv in the 80s. You know, not everyone may know this, but there was a time when actually Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza could roam around freely in Israel, and Israelis could go to the West Bank and Gaza from around 1972 to the start of the Second Intifada in 2001. So he was one of those who took advantage of that freedom of movement and moved to Tel Aviv, which I'm not sure was legal at the time because you could only be in Israel during the day, but whatever he did. And he knows Israelis. He speaks Hebrew. He said that Tel Aviv is his favorite city in Palestine, which may sound controversial to some. And he's like, you know, like given my personal experience, I got along with Israelis. I don't see why not all Palestinians could get along with Israelis. We should all learn Hebrew and we should be one big happy family.
Yeah, I thought the interview was so colorful and really insightful into his mind, at least. I just, as I mentioned, I'm wondering how much it represents Gazans in general. Another statement that he said is that we are all held hostage by Hamas. And do you think that that is shared by most Gazans at this point?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've spoken with other people in Gaza off the record. And obviously, I mean, the people that I speak with don't want Hamas in power for sure. And they're also more and more vocal about it. I interviewed a Gazan guy in the summer by email. And he sent me like his criticism of Hamas, and right after he deleted his email, and I never knew what it was. And recently I spoke with him again, and he told me his full name. He came out publicly against Hamas, and it seems to be more and more widespread because people say, I mean, Hamas is no longer patrolling the streets; they no longer have a hold over their life.
But yet he did say that Hamas is still around, maybe not patrolling the streets as much as it was, but that it's everywhere, that it's still widespread throughout the strip. That's what Sami seemed to say.
Yes. So he says there's still a Hamas presence. There's still a Hamas police. One thing that I found very interesting is also he said that the aid trucks coming into Rafah, which is where he is now, a lot of them are taken over by Hamas, which sometimes it keeps the aid to itself, but sometimes it's also distributed to the population. So there is still a Hamas presence, but it's not what it used to be, definitely. And they also see, not in Rafah specifically, but around the strip, they also see the IDF going around and patrolling.
I thought it was really interesting as well that he said that he goes to the beach every day. And in fact, we included in the article TikTok that he made of himself walking on the beach. And he's actually quite active on TikTok.
Yes, that was very surprising. I myself am not on TikTok, and he has apparently been very active on TikTok lately. He's been filming whatever he sees around the streets of Rafah and the beach, and he says that's what keeps him alive, and it's also the reason why he loves Tel Aviv so much. He goes on these long walks because he has nothing else to do, like everyone. He is one of the lucky ones that has a roof over his head because he had family in Rafah, so they moved from north of Gaza to Rafah in the early days of the war, and there's nothing else to do. Like, he was a kind of a heavy smoker before the war, like many Palestinians. He now cannot afford cigarettes because they cost 500 shekels a packet. He said, ironically, that Israel probably thinks that they're building rockets with the cigarettes. So he really doesn't have anything else to do with his time. So he just goes on these long walks, like 10, 12 kilometers a day. He's 2 kilometers away from the coast now. So it takes him sometimes to get to the beach, and he just goes on the long walks on the beach. And you can see in his TikTok videos, there's a lot of Gazans, you know, going to the sea, just spending time there because it's probably safer than other places.
Right. So listeners, please check out a link in the program notes and read this really insightful interview. Now, just to close with, you brought to my attention yesterday, Luca, a story about Jordanians who were selling rocket shrapnel from the Iran strike online. And I haven't read your story yet, I have to admit, but can you tell us a little bit about this phenomenon?
Yeah, the story is not out yet. I was actually quite disappointed to see that these ads on the Jordanian equivalent of like Craigslist have been taken down now. I was disappointed because I actually wanted to buy an Iranian rocket. Sounded like a cool thing to have. These people found these things in nature or even in the suburbs of Amman and were selling them online. The price range was quite interesting because some of them went for $130. There was a guy who was trying to sell a whole rocket for, I think, 120,000 dinars, which is like $160,000, like a crazy price. I don't know if he was lucky enough to find a buyer.
But it's been taken down, and there were no rockets, according to the Jordanian press. Anyway, these are perhaps UFO parts.
Probably, yes. Yeah. If you ask the Jordanian government, yes.
Luca, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.